Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
This is Mark Sobel, U.S. Chair, OnFit. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by colleagues from my government career to discuss where U.S.-China relations stand now and where they may head under a Biden administration. Ambassador Kurt Tong is a partner and member of the Executive Committee of the Asia Group. He leads the group's work on East Asia regional issues. He worked for 30 years in the State Department. He was a leading architect of the TPP, U.S.-Korea trade agreements. He played a pivotal role on APEC. He served in China and Korea. He headed up the NSC Asia section. He was deputy chief of mission in Japan. So as you can see, one of our foremost Asia experts. Wendy Cutler is vice president at the Asia Society Policy Institute and the managing director of the Washington office. She had a three-decade-long career as a diplomat and negotiator in the office of the U.S. Trade Representative, where she also served as the acting deputy U.S. Trade Representative. She's worked on bilateral, regional, and multilateral trade negotiations, including with Korea, TPP, U.S.-China talks, WTO financial services negotiations. There's nothing in the world of trade she hasn't done. And Bob Doner was Deputy Assistant Secretary for Asia at the U.S. Treasury for a decade, Mr. Asia, as we called him, and he was the Chief Economist at Treasury's International Affairs Department as well. He was Treasury's attaché in Tokyo for many years, another Asia expert. So apart from the outstanding qualities of today's panelists, what makes this discussion more special is that they came from different agencies, state, USTR, and Treasury, which have different perspectives, but often need to work together, and all three know each other well from their careers. So I plan to lead our panelists in a general discussion, and I hope we'll turn then to audience questions, and they can be submitted by the chat function. So let's dig in. China has become the world's second largest economy and a power in its own right. There's a narrative in D.C. that Obama treated China benignly and Trump was tough. That is a caricature in my view, and I felt Obama was much tougher in his second term, which coincided with President Xi's rise and growing authoritarianism, though he certainly wasn't as vociferous as Trump. Of course, China under Trump was seen as a geostrategic competitor. That's a shared view across the U.S. political spectrum. The word decoupling was in the air. It seemed as if the U.S.-China relationship was perceived as zero sum. There was much tension. So let's dig in and try and explore in a first round what you, given your backgrounds, believe Trump got right or wrong. So let me lead off with Kurt, given your role at Asia Group and as a former State Department officer. Could you kick us off with some points from a broader geostrategic perspective? What do you think Trump got right and wrong?
Thanks, Mark, and thanks for including me today. I think that one of the when people compare Trump to Obama or Trump to Biden, but particularly Trump to Obama, they're making the assumption that it's the U.S. that is the only element that can change in the equation of U.S.-China relations. And in fact, in the late Obama administration and then into the Trump administration, it was the Chinese side that was changing policy most dramatically, in becoming more confrontational toward the West, more authoritarian internally, and more aggressive regionally. And that, I think, resulted in a change in the thought processes of really most of the national security community in Washington and in the United States, coalescing around this idea that the relationship with China had shifted to one that could best be described as strategic competition. And that has become a consensus view, really, across parties in the national security crowd and within the Biden administration. What the criticism of the Biden people, and I share this, is that the Trump team got the analysis right. And if you look at their national security strategy, it captured fairly much consensus agreed upon elements of what is concerning about China from the U.S. perspective, but that the actions taken were politically driven, and meant to gather attention and look tough rather than necessarily be tough. And so you ended up with this blunderbuss approach of the first half of the Trump administration concentrating almost solely on negotiating trade agreements. And then the second half of the administration, President Trump telling his national security team, well, just, you know, do whatever you want. Get out, again, a blunderbuss and just fire it away and see where those things fire. And so I think the Biden team will try to be more precise, and choose issues that matter in the competition with China and be, you know, if necessary, confrontational on those. And so I think we'll see a combination of confrontation, on some issues, outright cooperation on some, if it's possible. China likes to link things, the cooperation to then reduced confrontation on other issues. And if China does that, the cooperation might not develop. But I think we can see that. And then a lot of negotiation on some of the difficult issues in between. And the other characteristic, I think, key characteristic of the Biden team will be that they're going to very much put more effort into coordination with allies. That's not going to necessarily be easy. You don't just say, hey, let's all do this together and it happens. The agenda setting is extraordinarily complex, and then coming up with the right alignments, the right trade-offs, and agreement on what and what is not on the table in terms of trying to, in a sense, shave off the negative implications of China's rise without questioning its rise. But doing that in a coordinated fashion across friends and allies, it will be very complicated.
Well, great. Well, thank you for that. And we'll come back to where Biden should head. But that was a wonderful depiction of the current state of relations. So, Wendy, in Washington, the narrative is China cheats on trade, forcing firms to transfer their technological know-how, excessively subsidizing firms through industrial policy and state capitalism, stealing intellectual property. It's perceived as a threat to us on the technological front. We see that with Huawei and TikTok. Trump's response, as Kurt was just alluding to, was rhetoric, tariffs, phase one deal, entity lists, and the like. So what's your take on what he got right and wrong and where we are right now before we in the next round plunge into where Biden should go?
Well, first, thanks for inviting me. And it's a real pleasure to be with Mark, Kurt, and Bob. I mean, I have to say, when we worked on these issues for many, many years, we didn't always see eye to eye. And we were involved in some pretty tense interagency meetings. But I will say, whenever I went overseas, I always felt that we spoke as one. And that's so important. And I really look forward to kind of that return of just deliberate policy making when all views are held, but, you know, they're not broadcasted on Twitter. You know, they're real thorough and very educated and tough policy coordination. But then again, we go overseas, we're one government with one position. So I really valued our collegiality. You know, I think Kurt got it right in terms of, you know, where Obama left off and where Trump picked up. China changed. And Kurt, you mentioned, you know, they became more assertive regionally, more authoritarian domestically, but also they really stalled on their reform and opening agenda. You know, with the possible exception of financial services, which I know you guys care a lot about. But, you know, if you put that market aside, we really saw reform stall in many, many other sectors as the state got more and more involved in the economy. So what did Trump get right? I think Kurt really touched on most of the issues. I'd add just a few. I mean, not only did he bring China front and center on the agenda, but he also put a bright light, and here I give Ambassador Lighthizer a lot of credit, on a lot of the structural and really unfair practices that China was following, whether it be on IPR or on technology transfer, on, you know, excessive subsidies that were creating and create enormous overcapacity globally, as well as other practices. And the final observation, and I put this somewhere in the got the right category, is he was really willing to take on the business community when it came to China. Because one of my frustrations, and I'm not alone at USTR through the years working on China, was that our companies were pretty conflicted. On one hand, they liked the access they were getting, the market that they were serving, and the money they were making. They wanted us to be, quote unquote, tough with China, but they also didn't want to be part of the get tough strategy. They wanted it both ways. And as a result, I think our hands were tied in a way that, you know, all of those cords were cut in the Trump administration. But let's be honest, he got a lot wrong. I mean, frankly, it was a unilateral approach. I think there was severe miscalculation at the beginning. I think the Trump team, based on their earlier days with Japan, and this is where, particularly with respect to Ambassador Lighthizer, I think he felt we're going to threaten tariffs. We'll threaten a lot of tariffs, and then China will come to the table and make concessions in all of these areas. And they weren't prepared for counter retaliation. And if you had a real policy process, I think people like who are on this call would say, well, we should get ready for counter retaliation. And so, as we all know, this spiraled into retaliation affecting hundreds of billions of dollars of imports and exports that are still in place today. Second, not only did he not work with allies and partners on the China strategy, but he alienated them through other measures, whether it be steel and aluminum tariffs, discussion of the level of forces and who's paying for them, et cetera. And third, he didn't stay the course. So while he put all these really important issues on the agenda, at the end of the day, he settled for a subpar agreement, the phase one agreement, which really put off the issues of subsidies, state-owned enterprises, cyber theft, and even the areas of technology transfer and IPR, which were addressed in the phase one agreement. The administration admitted there was more work to be done in these areas. And I would just then conclude with one other observation where I think he got it wrong, and that is the whole negotiating style of the Trump administration. It was done in public a lot on Twitter, and I think that just puts both sides in boxes and makes it harder to find common ground. The priorities were shifting all the time. One day it was the trade deficit, the next day was the structural issues, then it was the purchasing commitments. And as a result, I think, the negotiation wasn't focused enough on what was really important and what needed to be solved in order to reach a deal. And I would just conclude and say a lot of it was very top down, coming from the president, even with the president kind of discrediting his own negotiators at times. And we all know if you're going to be effective overseas as a representative of the U.S. government, the other side needs to know that you have the mandate, you have the credibility, and what you agree to, you can bring home. And frankly, he undermined a lot of his negotiators, including at the cabinet level.
Thank you for that. Yes, he didn't make much progress on the structural issues. The deficit with China went down, but the overall U.S. deficit has gone up. And when you try and negotiate with a gun to the Chinese head, they don't budge at all. Treasury worked well with the People's Bank and the Finance Ministry over the years. A lot of common interests on global financial stability, sound economies. They need to work together in the G20, the IMF, the FSB. The currency policy problems had waned by the time Trump took over. China's external surplus was small. But as Wendy said, Trump focused on bilateral balances. CFIUS and financial sanctions, which Treasury oversees, became a far more prominent issue. Trump wouldn't engage. There were concerns about Chinese debt trap diplomacy. So from the standpoint of a former Treasury official, what do you think he got right and wrong?
Well, Thanks, Mark. And it's a pleasure to be here with people I've worked with and respected for, gosh, a couple decades. First, I think Treasury did have a more cordial relationship with the Ministry of Finance and the People's Bank of China, partly because there was a large overlap of common interests on economic recovery and financial stability after the global financial crisis, but also because what we were calling for was in many cases what those agencies were arguing for internally. But they weren't patsies, and neither were we. And where areas where our interests diverged, official export credits, rules for exchange rate policy, international debt workout, it was really a hard slog. You talked a little bit about what Trump got right and got wrong. First, what he got right was identified China as a strategic competitor and as a threat in several areas. That was coming, but it was a clear and decisive shift. Second, I'll disagree with you, Mark, here, because I think the Chinese do respond to a direct threat to their interest. And the Trump administration was willing to marshal the leverage of the U.S. government, primarily through tariffs, in a way that we'd never been able to do before. That opened up opportunities that hadn't existed before. And finally, as Wendy mentioned, the USTR 301 report really set out the issues that mattered in the U.S.-China economic relations, Chinese industrial policy, but also Chinese technology acquisition policy. Unfortunately, the administration squandered the opportunity that they created. They settled for a big transaction deal rather than dealing with the structural issues. It's sort of debatable in retrospect, but I think there was an opportunity in early 2020 to deal with the structural issues the 301 report identified. Second, they never developed off-ramps for the tariffs that they imposed. So that both reduced the leverage, basically eliminated the "we'll take these away if you do this," but it also left the United States and China with vastly increased bilateral tariffs on each other, creating an encumbered trade area between the two. And finally, the Trump administration swung too far on the adversary approach to China and gave up the ability to shape Chinese behavior. Saw this in the approach to Huawei. It became a jihad. It was never clear whether it was a national security issue or an attempt to drive the company out of business. And it convinced China to double down on their industrial policy and technology acquisition policy, the very things that we were objecting to. Let me talk a little bit in my own lane about Treasury issues, and that's the foreign exchange report. Foreign exchange report was always an unloaded gun. It was always more intimidating when we were waving it around than it was if we actually used it. The Trump administration unfortunately turned the foreign exchange report into a farce. When they named China in August 2019 as a currency manipulator for no real reason, and then unnamed them 6 months later in January 2020, when they announced the phase one deal. People ask me about the foreign exchange report, will Treasury designate particular countries? And my response is often, who cares? So I view the Trump administration as a decisive change in U.S. policy, a huge opportunity that was squandered, and also a hardening of positions on both sides that's very difficult to reverse and creates a difficult situation for the Biden administration.
Well, thank you for that. So let's look forward. I hear all of you saying that China changed on the heels of Obama's growing concerns. Trump amped up the concerns to the hilt, but that he correctly identified China as a growing strategic challenge to the world. But at the same time, he was belligerent. He didn't pragmatically lend the administration to effective dialogue, and he didn't find solutions. So with that inheritance, then the questions are, you know, what lessons can the Biden team draw and where should it head? And I'd like to like do this in two rounds, maybe start with substance and then have a quick round on process if I can artificially divide the two. Kurt, you began to talk about the bigger picture of where Biden needs to go. But can we see it as a strategic competitor, take a tough line and yet work with them? And to what extent does the fact that the U.S. has damaged its global brand in recent years impact Biden's approach?
Those are both great questions. The I think that looking at the substance of the matter, on the highest priorities would be technology, the military balance in the Western Pacific, and the whole all the questions around good governance and democracy and human rights. The all of which are essentially confrontation issues, as opposed to cooperation issues. So on the technology front, I think the U.S. objective will be to try and maintain a lead in certain core technologies, which are important for future economic growth, but also important for maintaining a military advantage. And that we're all familiar with these semiconductors, quantum computing technology, artificial intelligence applications, the robotics, materials, et cetera. That would be number one. Number two, maintaining military balance requires switching out equipment to a significant degree in the U.S. military's forward presence, making it more mobile, less manned, more unmanned, harder to hit, and faster in hitting back. And that will require a lot of investment and close cooperation with Japan, with Taiwan, with Korea, Australia, and others. And then on the democracy front, I think the goal is no longer to try really to change China, because the corollary of China as a strategic competitor that does not accept the appeal to shared responsibility being a responsible stakeholder in the global system, et cetera, et cetera, that it has in fact decided to be an authoritarian state and will remain that way. Then it's a question of making sure that the discussion around governance is sufficiently pointed that it influences the thinking in other countries, but doesn't get you trapped into trying to raise expectations that somehow you're going to be able to change how China governs itself. So those, I think, are really key elements. There's going to be a whole range of policies that come out in support of each of those. They're all confrontational. You mentioned cooperation aspects. There are things which the U.S. and China could cooperate on. The coronavirus response being one of them. They both sides dropped the ball on that in 2020, but there is more to do still going forward in terms of getting the rest of the planet vaccinated. North Korea is an obvious cooperation point, nuclear proliferation, weapons proliferation in general, and climate change. But I don't think that the Biden administration, at least as Joe Biden intends, is going to see any trade-offs between the confrontation issues and the cooperation ones. And rather, these are in China's interests. And they will cooperate with the United States and with other countries if they see it as in their interest, and they act in their interest. So they drown and starve and get dried up just as much as the rest of us due to climate change. So do we need to negotiate climate change targets with China? Why do we need to negotiate that? They should set their own targets, and we should set our targets. And then, when they don't do enough, we criticize them. That's the negotiation. So we don't really need to be happy together as we do this. We can just, talk about it. And I think that's true in a lot of these, so-called cooperation areas. And I think that's actually kind of how it's going to play out.
Great. Well, thank you for that. Wendy, trade and technology in general, and what's going to happen to tariffs and 301 tariffs? And many think they're going to stay on for a while, and it won't be easy for Biden to climb down. Another, will there be talks which actually get at structural issues such as industrial policy, and can China deliver? And given your Asia Society hat, I'd really like to know your views on getting back into TPP, what to make of RCEP, and I read recently that you've suggested that sectoral deals could be a TPP alternative.
Okay, that's a lot. So just some reactions. You know, in some ways, the tariffs that have been left for Biden, he's inherited, it's about tariffs on about $370 billion worth of Chinese imports into the United States. In some ways, you know, they could be important leverage. But I would also argue, I think people have gotten kind of, the Chinese and others have kind of gotten used to those tariffs. They seem predictable and certain, you know, there's certainty around them. No one's looking to increase those tariffs. So I wonder if that leverage may be overestimated as people have gotten used to them. That said, I think that if the Biden administration can get China to move on some key issues, you know, these tariffs could, in theory, be lifted. I don't think they need to be lifted all at once. You can do it tranche by tranche. You can reduce the rates. Most of the tariffs are at the rate of 25%. So there's a lot to play with there. But I will say Congress is going to be watching very closely in terms of what the Biden team does with tariffs, what they do with the export controls they inherited, what they do with the sanctions they inherited, trying to pounce on Biden and his team if there's any whiff of weakness. And I think that became apparent during some of the hearings of some of the senior cabinet appointees of the Biden administration. So I don't expect the tariffs to be lifted anytime soon, but I would hope that over time we could find ways to work with China to address some really pressing issues and maybe lift them, you know, step by step. One thing I think the Biden administration can do, and with respect to tariffs, is really improve the process for seeking exclusions to these tariffs. And in this manner, I think you can put forward a process that's more transparent, more predictable. When you get an exclusion, it stays for longer. But, and also an exclusion process where, there's a greater receptivity to the concerns of businesses and workers. It seems like the exclusion process that has been, pursued by USTR to date has been very biased towards not lifting and not providing sanctions and exclusions and not really listening to valid concerns. With respect to these so-called phase two issues, which includes issues that were partially addressed in phase one, like IPR and tech transfer, and the phase two issues, including cyber, subsidies, and state-owned enterprises, I just don't see the Biden administration, like, hopping into a bilateral negotiation with China on all of these issues. I think that at least what I would recommend if I were part of the team would be, let's look at each issue individually, figure out the most effective way to address it, figure out who our allies and partners are on these issues, and also determine whether a multilateral solution makes more sense, particularly in the area of subsidies, and if so, give the WTO a chance to work on this. So I would argue for kind of a more, you know, a detailed approach with respect to all these different issues versus bundling them all up and trying to bring them to the table bilaterally to and work with China on them. I don't see that leading to success anytime soon. And just to switch gears for a minute here, your questions on RCEP and TPP. I mean, one concern I have is that China is moving pretty quickly on the trade front in the trade and investment front in the world. And we've seen just in the past few months, They were one of the key signatories to the RCEP agreement. At the end of the year, they just concluded an investment deal with Europe. They're talking about and revamping the trilateral negotiations with Japan and Korea, and even possibly entering CPTPP as an accession partner. And so China, again, it's not standing still, and neither are the other countries in Asia, frankly, either. And the Biden administration right now, and rightfully so, is focusing on domestic issues, but also talking about it needs time to review all these policies and develop its own strategies for going forward. So what I'm concerned about is that there'll be a real gap there, and that when we're ready to reengage, the world's going to even move on even further away from us than it is now. And that's one of the reasons why I've been advocating that the United States should think about doing limited, narrow sectoral agreements in the region. And I think the areas of digital, medical, supply chains, and climate and trade are three areas just kind of ripe for such an approach, and engage countries in the region on those issues. And, you know, then take your time about figuring out if and when you would want to return to a TPP-like agreement. And my final point would be, if we were ever to return to TPP or CPTPP, as it's called now, let's be honest, we would need to seek major revisions and updates. And while other countries, I think, want us back in, and they'll have some bandwidth for accepting some changes, I think the United States would need to be very judicious about the changes that they would be seeking to that agreement. And that may just be a bridge too far that can't be cracked. But, you know, from my vantage point, I would hope that we would look at that approach again, working with like-minded countries on a whole slew of issues going forward.
Thank you for that. Well, Bob, looking forward, Biden administration, macro, FX, CFIUS, financial sanctions, China's opening to U.S. financial firms recently a little bit, but there's U.S. proposals to restrict Chinese capital market access to the U.S. And then there's the Chinese overseas lending, a full plate. Any thoughts?
Sure. First is the character of Treasury's interaction with China has changed. It's less macroeconomic, less financial services now. And it shifted more towards administration of the CFIUS process and also administration of financial sanctions. I think the one clear exception in macro is the looming international debt distress and debt default issues. Countries have borrowed after COVID. That'll involve some hard negotiations, but I think that will work out. On financial services, ironically, the Chinese waited too long to open up their financial sector, and they aren't getting any credit for it. It's just not what the administration cares about. It's not an issue that affects ordinary Americans. And I think it was Jake Sullivan who said recently that it would not be a particular priority of the Biden administration. The CFIUS investment review process has expanded to include venture capital funding, to include collection of personal data, transfer of technology to joint ventures, and is also, I think, going to become more important internationally as the United States works with other countries to strengthen their investment screening process. Financial sanctions is an area where there's just been an inexorable increase in the scope and the extent of financial sanctions. Originally, they were terrorist finance and money laundering, but they've expanded to include human rights issues and also general countering of U.S. adversaries. They've also begun to lean in towards secondary sanctions, where you sanction a foreign entity, including possibly a bank, because it deals with a directly sanctioned entity. Sanctioning a major Chinese bank, cutting it off from the U.S. financial system, would be a huge step and a potentially financially destabilizing step. One I think the Yellen Treasury will weigh in heavily on. In the area of investments, I think there are going to be a number of restrictions on U.S. investments in China. Some of them will be symbolic and won't matter a great deal. But the thing I would particularly watch is what the Biden administration does with a Department of Defense list of companies that are linked to the Chinese military and are therefore banned for investment by U.S. agents, individuals, and firms. That's a big deal. The other thing that I would watch carefully, an agency not represented here, but one that's going to be very important in the Biden administration, is the Commerce Department. Commerce has issued interim final rules on a CFIUS-like process for examining transactions in ICT services, products, maintenance, software updates that is potentially extremely wide in its scope and could do a great deal to to harm U.S. interests, U.S. companies, disrupt supply chains, and do a considerable amount of damage. In addition, Commerce Department also has to come out with definitions of foundational technologies and emerging technologies. And when they do that, it will strengthen both export controls and also the administration of the CFIUS process. So that's a space to definitely watch.
Well, thank you. You have the last word. I thank Bob, Wendy, Kurt for joining me today. It was extremely kind of you to share your precious time with us. Thank you for your wonderful answers and insights. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFIF podcast.